Is the United States funding terrorists in Central America? And my name is Jack Nelson Hallmeyer. I thought I wanted to just start out by asking, how did you feel about the question? I heard a couple of people, the reason I asked is I heard a couple of people who may or may not have known who I am looking at the board, and they were looking at it, and they came across this title, and they said, look at this. Is the United States funding terrorism? They said, don't they know we're Americans? So I just wonder, I understand that. I think that maybe there are some people, and one of the things we try to be at Holden is try to get things out and have people participate honestly. I hope we'll do that tonight. I'm going to try to talk about a fairly complicated question in a relatively short period of time and offer a lot of time for discussion. But how do people feel about it? Do some people, are you angry about the question even? Does it hit you as, no, we could, the United States just wouldn't do that? Is that part of the feeling, or how do people feel?
My response was, is there any question?
So a lot of people do feel like that is what's happening in Central America, and others maybe are maybes. Okay. Well, with that in mind, maybe we'll be able to get some diverse opinions shared after I lay out some background. I put together this outline, but I wanted to say a couple of things, kind of a preface to this. And the first is to say that I answer the question as yes, the United States is, and I do that for the following reasons. The first is personal experience. As many of you know by now, Sarah and I lived in the country of Nicaragua for 2 years, returned to this country about a year ago. We've been traveling to Central America over the last about four and a half years. And I just returned 2 weeks ago tomorrow from El Salvador and Nicaragua. And so we could spend a fair amount of time, I could just tell you stories about U.S.-sponsored terrorism in Central America. Many of you are probably familiar that Nicaragua had an insurrection that overthrew a U.S.-backed government in 1979, and that more or less since that time, the U.S. has been funding a group called the Contras. They're in the news a lot. Conversation is going on of whether we should fund them. So from personal experience, Sarah and I can tell you what the Contras do. We see them blow up health clinics. We see them and we know that they put landmines in roads that civilian vehicles travel on and hit very regularly. We know that they target teachers and health workers and land reform workers and people who have gotten land reform in Nicaragua's land reform for assassination. So the first is, and we can talk more about this later if you want, is through personal experience. And that's very hard to deal with as a U.S. person. If any of you felt twinges of guilt over the last week and a half of thinking about Rainbow, some of us probably did at points, and that's healthy, certainly can magnify that in terms of our feelings of being in Nicaragua and seeing what's happening, and also in El Salvador and seeing what's happening there. Second, I say yes to my own question based on the statements of Contra leaders. Some of you may be familiar that Edgar Chamorro, who was one of the principal Contra leaders, left the Contra because he couldn't stomach the terrorism. And he testified before the World Court that when he complained to U.S. policymakers and when he complained to the Central Intelligence Agency that basically runs that war about the terrorism directed against civilians in Nicaragua, he was told that the only way to fight and win this war is through terrorism. So, okay, that's an inside source. Some of you may remember about a year and a half ago, there seemed to be a shift in the Contra strategy. And that shift included starting to assassinate Western European workers. There are hundreds, perhaps even thousands, of Western Europeans who are working within Nicaragua on various kinds of projects. An intentional decision was made to start killing some of them by the Contras. And in response to that, over one of the contrabass radio stations, after some Western Europeans had been killed, one of the spokespeople for the Contra leaders said, "We are going on record that all international workers are being viewed as legitimate military targets in Nicaragua." So again, from what the Contras say themselves. Tomorrow, I'll be talking a lot more about who Oliver North is, who he works for, what the network of people that he's connected to. One of those people is a man named Thomas Posey. And Thomas Posey is basically a mercenary that has helped put together the Contras, helped provide them illegally with guns, with the help of Oliver North and people within the National Security Council. Again, what did he say? He told reporters with a certain amount of pride that his network was funneling explosives into the Contras to be used against civilian targets to terrorize the people. Another inside source. And then the fourth reason that I answered yes to my own question is through international independent sources. If you want to read about the human rights situation in Nicaragua, which is somewhat at times critical of the present Nicaraguan government, and you want to read, you know, kind of independent views of that, read Amnesty International and see what they say about the U.S. and the U.S.-backed Contras. Read America's Watch. Those are both internationally recognized human rights organizations. And see what they say. Read the World Court decision. Not many U.S. people know about the World Court decision, which was a decision by the highest court in the world that condemned the U.S. action against Nicaragua. And fewer still know that the majority of nations who represented who are represented in the World Court in terms of have judges sitting on the bench are from U.S. allies. And yet they condemned the U.S. action against Nicaragua. So for all of those reasons, I answered the question yes. But what I want to do tonight is to focus on where does terrorism fit into an overall warfare strategy that's being practiced in Central America. Tomorrow, as I said, I'm going to focus on the real story behind Contragate, as laid out particularly by the Christic Institute, which is an interfaith, primarily Catholic, public legal service outfit that has filed one of the most incredible suits in the history of this country that I will be talking about that really gets at the root and basically says that we are living with a cancer inside the bowels of the U.S. government. And unless we cut that cancer out, we are going to condemn ourselves, basically, to dictatorship at home, not just funding dictatorship abroad. Now, I'm not going to say more about that now. That's tomorrow's agenda. But if it intrigues you, I invite you to come. I don't know whether I'll be able to present it well enough, but it's better than any international thriller that you've ever heard, except it's a little more depressing because it's real. And then the final day, tomorrow I'm on at 4, and then Saturday, I can't remember what time I'm on, I'm going to do something on the Nicaraguan economy and what changes have taken place in Nicaragua since 1979, and what is it about those changes that is so threatening? In other words, we'll look at Nicaragua. Is it totalitarian? Is it communist? What is the Soviet influence? But we'll take a real hard look at what the internal changes are in Nicaragua. Okay, I've already used up 10 minutes. I put this outline on, and so if any of you are interested in taking notes, I'll be kind of following that outline. To do this topic justice, we could use a couple of days, or at least a couple hours. So I'm going to be less than complete, but I would rather err on that side and allow more time for discussion. So I'm going to run through this fairly briefly, and then, again, try to allow almost a full half hour for a conversation. Now, where terrorism fits into the overall warfare strategy, it's important to understand the term low-intensity conflict. This is the Pentagon term. It's not my term. This is how our Pentagon now defines the principal means of warfare that the U.S. is using, particularly in terms of with third world countries. Now, it's important to understand that low-intensity conflict is not something new. It's an adaptation of what we've called in the past counterinsurgency warfare. Now, you know, we're involved in a counterinsurgency warfare in Vietnam. We've been involved since the 1960s in the idea of counterinsurgency warfare, which basically redefined warfare in a way and said that the threat, for example, to a country like Guatemala, which was a U.S. ally, was not that someone from the outside was going to invade them. The threat was from within, that the people would rise up against injustice or rise up and demand land reform or rise up and demand making changes. And therefore, those populations had to be controlled internally. That's counterinsurgency warfare. You were trying to put down revolutions, insurrections from within a people. You're not so much worried about a foreign country invading. Now, part of the doctrine, obviously, is that, well, the threat is internal, okay, but maybe that's really being sponsored by the Soviet Union or Cuba, etc. That's part of the ideology. But the strategy is counterinsurgency warfare, training police forces, training military forces to deal with internal problems. And doing that, usually combining military means, police training, but also some economic incentives, economic carrots at times. Okay, the basic worldview. I find the basic worldview really frightening. The first is that peace does not exist. The basic worldview of the people who are developing our strategy of warfare that's being tested in Central America says peace is an illusion. That the United States is at war, constantly at war, and if we're not aware of that and we're not actively fighting wars on all kinds of levels that I'll get to, then we're losing war. Then we're losing the war. In other words, if we think the peace is real, we're going to lose the war. We're always fighting wars, and we've got to be fighting wars constantly, economically, politically, militarily, and I'll get to that. Okay, a second part of the worldview is that there are only two choices for countries. Particularly now underdeveloped countries, or third world countries, we got all kinds of labels. They can either choose to be dominated by the United States, or they have de facto chosen to be dominated by the Soviet Union. In other words, all the world is interpreted through an east-west lens. You're either with us, you're against us. You make the wrong choice, you're going to be at war with us, in ways that I'll define. Third part, and I could read from this, I've got, if any of you are interested, part of this is gleaned from a document that was prepared in preparation for the 1980 election by the Reagan administration called the Santa Fe Report. And I have some very interesting quotes that a lot of this is coming from this Santa Fe document. I'm not going to take the time to read them. But another concept is that we're already losing World War III. Now, who would we fight, do you think, if we were fighting World War III? Who's the enemy likely to be? Russia, Soviet Union. Well, we got that part right. But what they say is, yes, we're fighting World War III, and we, in fact, are fighting the Soviet Union because everything is east-west. But we don't want a nuclear war with the Soviet Union because that would be too costly. Too many U.S. people would die. So we'll prepare for nuclear superiority, but we don't want to fight a nuclear war. We'll prepare for conventional war with the Soviet Union, but we don't want to fight that war because it'll be too costly. Too many U.S. people will die. So World War III is being fought now, and according to the logic of these people, we're already losing it, but where it's being fought is on the periphery of the empire. Central America is on the periphery. Countries in Africa are on the third world is defined as is all those fringe countries that the world empires are clashing over. Okay. Fourth part of the background and worldview is that it redefines the notion of total war. When I think of total war, I think of nuclear war. That's not true for low-intensity war advocates. For them, what total war means is you're using everything possible in your warfare, and what I mean by that is you integrate economic warfare techniques, and I'll define those in a minute, psychological warfare techniques, military warfare techniques, and diplomatic warfare techniques. So it's an integration of all those things on the economic front, on the psychological front, on the diplomatic front, and on the military front. You're weaving that together in a comprehensive strategy of warfare. And I call that the U.S. form of totalitarianism. Because what the U.S. is trying to do in Central America is to control all events by economic means, psychological means, diplomatic means, and military means, all woven together in a neat package. And I'll give you examples of those in a few minutes. Okay, let's move on to lessons from the past. Again, I said low-intensity conflict is not something new. It tries to build on and improve on past efforts. Vietnam, in some ways, was a failure, right? Indochina. Some of our efforts in Guatemala and Chile look really clumsy. You know, everybody knows that the CIA overthrew the government in Guatemala in 1954. It's pretty clumsy, and what happened afterwards wasn't too neat. So we want to do it better. So what lessons did they learn? First one, hearts and minds. That it's not enough to win territory. Not enough to control territory. You want to try to control the hearts and minds of people. Well, there are all kinds of ways that you can do that. But the goal here is to separate people from groups that are demanding fundamental social changes. Because fundamental social changes are seen as being against U.S. interests. So you want to separate the people from those things. Well, how do you do that? I'll give you some examples. One is if you look at El Salvador, land reform. All of a sudden the U.S. started to impose a land reform program on El Salvador. Well, that sounds good, right? Everybody who knows something about hunger will tell you land reform is very important. But the land reform in El Salvador was very cosmetic. In other words, it didn't really redistribute any power. It left things intact, but it was a way of trying to... The revolutionary group fighting the government in El Salvador has land reform as a major platform. So what do? You implement a land reform. Only it's not a very effective land reform. If you want to talk to me about the specifics of that, I'll save that for the questions. Another way that you separate people from revolutionary groups is you bomb the hell out of them. So you see that going on at the same time in El Salvador, where massive bombings of the countryside to displace, uproot people who are seen as a sea of support for the Salvadoran revolution. You just uproot them, put them more or less in concentration camp type conditions. And then you start trying to re-educate them with programs. And you have the military handing out food, which is going on in El Salvador today, etc. Okay, so hearts and minds are important. You want to manage social change. Again, one of the lessons is coups aren't very effective. A coup is just simply a change at the top, and you still have all these things going on at the surface that can bubble up. If you don't deal with people's hearts and minds, and if you don't at least have some cosmetic reforms, a coup isn't going to be very effective. U.S. has had coups all over the world, but the conditions that give rise to the rebellion continue. So this is an effort to try to deepen that a little bit. Third, this is very important to understand this, is that a lesson from the Vietnam War is if you have U.S. people dying, people get upset about that in the United States. In Central America, we're going to fight a war where U.S. people don't die. So what do? We fund the Contras. We form the Contras. And I'll talk about that tomorrow. We form, we create, we keep alive the Contras. And they're doing our dirty work, but we don't have U.S. people coming back in body bags. Why don't we have a draft in this country? We don't have a draft in this country because if you had a draft, all the young people in this country of draft age would suddenly be concerned about Central America, and so would their parents. So rather than have a draft, we send down the National Guard, and we send down the National Reserve, and we do all these training exercises getting ready for an invasion of Central America, but it's all done quite neatly and quite quietly. Again, you build up the army in El Salvador. You build up the armies in Honduras. Now, what I want to point out in the context of Rainbow Week is that what this is really based on is racism. A fundamental tenet of low-intensity conflict is racism. That we won't care if dark people are killing each other. We won't care as long as white sons don't come back in body bags. Very well calculated, and it's very well done in terms of the impact. We would have a much greater protest about Central America. And I'm going to talk about the concentration camps that are being built in the United States today because they're very afraid of what happens when the U.S. invades Central America. Talk about that tomorrow. Okay, fourth, the importance of repression. One of the lessons from the past and even the more recent present is that repression is very, very important. And in the case of El Salvador, it was used in a variety of ways. First, in the 1980, 81, 82 period, mass movements bubbling up, a lot of it Christian-based, coming out of the work of base Christian communities, Archbishop Romero aligning themselves with the people, movements demanding real restructuring of society. And what do? The United States helped sponsor one of the most unbelievable reigns of terror, in which in the last 5 or 6 years, more than 60,000 Salvadorans, most of them civilians, have been killed by death squads, by people in the armed forces, by people closely connected with the government, much of it with U.S. training. Okay, then you do that in 80, 81, 82, 83, and then you can reach a point where your repression doesn't have to be that anymore. It's more subtle. Then you just pick people up on the streets, you hold them for days, you assassinate a few key leaders here and there, because people have the memory of the past to keep them in line, right? What's happening in El Salvador, if some of you heard my talk a couple weeks ago, what's happening in El Salvador now, people's movements are starting to build again in spite of that memory of that repression. And what's happening? Death squads that the United States says, we've dismantled the death squads. They haven't been dismantled. They've been performing a very useful function. They've been more or less inactive, selectively active. But now they're getting more and more active as the movement builds. So repression is to be managed. And another point here, in El Salvador, our U.S. government leaders who have the brainchild of the low-intensity conflict, they knew that they couldn't carry out this war in El Salvador unless Congress would foot the bill. And Congress was getting real antsy about footing the bill when there were hundreds of people turning up in the streets of San Salvador every day. So it was tactically important to make this shift. But now it's beginning to build again. Okay, propaganda, we're the targets. One of the lessons from Vietnam is that our government has got to convince us that the enemy is real, and so we are the subjects of massive propaganda campaigns that I'll talk about a little bit more in a minute. And then the most cynical thing is that we've redefined victory. What do I mean by that? If you look at Nicaragua, there are three, under the low-intensity conflict umbrella, there are three notions of victory. The first, what we'd like to see, is the overthrow of the present Nicaraguan government, right? We want to get rid of those people. That's goal number one. That's the hope for goal. And if possible, we would like to put in someone a little less repressive than Somoza was. A Duarte-type figure. If you know anything about Duarte, he's a Christian Democrat. It's wonderful. Christian Democrat. What could be two finer words in the United States to sell, right? Christianity and democracy. It's terrific. Only Duarte doesn't have any power, right? But to put someone like that in power, that would be goal number one. Goal number two is if you can't do that, then victory becomes making people suffer. Victory becomes simply making people suffer. And if you're in Nicaragua very long and you see what the Contras do, you realize that that is in fact the goal right now. It's just to make people suffer. You blow up hospitals. You blow up schools. You put mines in the roads and blow them up. You attack campesinos. You assassinate teachers. You make it impossible for them to grow food in areas. All that is a definition of victory. That if, in other words, if we can't win and get our ultimate goal, we're going to make life miserable and we're going to make it clear to people around the world. And by the way, around the world, everybody, almost everybody who is struggling for some form of liberation in underdeveloped countries today, they know about Nicaragua. And what the U.S. wants them to know about Nicaragua in the second definition of victory is if you really want to seek those changes, this is what you can expect from the United States. And you better be ready for it. Okay, a third definition of victory, and I'll maybe talk more about this on Saturday, from the low-intensity conflict advocates, and this is really ironic, is if we could force Nicaragua into a closer relationship with Cuba and the Soviet Union, that's victory. I mean, that's really ironic, but that's victory. Why? Because it confirms your worldview. Why? Because it says the next time around, in the next place, probably the Philippines or somewhere, we're not going to let any of these stupid liberals who have been talking about there's a third way possible, we're not going to let that happen anymore because we're going to prove our position. Okay, so redefining victory. A couple more things and then I'll open it up. Let me give you examples of total war, is total war put into practice. So examples of economic warfare going on in Central America today. What did we do in Nicaragua right away, almost right away? I think this was in 1981. Cut off Nicaragua's sugar quota. So Nicaragua couldn't sell sugar to the United States at high prices, and we gave that sugar quota to Honduras and other Central American countries. The U.S. has effectively blocked all international loans to Nicaragua coming through agencies like the World Bank since 1981 to Nicaragua, because the U.S. has a lot of voting power in the World Bank. You know that we now have an economic embargo against Nicaragua. I don't know how many of you know, in order to declare that economic embargo, we are now living under a national emergency within the United States. How many of you knew that? In order to do that, we now have a national emergency. We're always not applying that in repressive ways to ourselves yet, but I'll talk about that prospect tomorrow. Okay, economic embargo. Restriction of humanitarian assistance. Groups like Oxfam America are being harassed by the government, prevented from making shipments of tools and other things under the definition of the embargo, which is defining humanitarian assistance in a very narrow way. Okay, another economic weapon, using debt as a weapon. In this book, The Politics of Compassion, I argue that debt is now the principal tool that the United States has to get other countries to do what they want them to do. It's not militarism, it's debt. Why does Costa Rica allow itself to be kind of used, particularly in the diplomatic sense, against Nicaragua? There's a joke in Costa Rica that says Costa Rica has 4 billion good reasons to do what the U.S. tells them to do. It's a $4 billion debt. Why is Honduras basically destroying itself in service to U.S. policy goals apart from its own interests? Tremendous dependency in debt. So that's another use, economic warfare. And then in Nicaragua, the Contra War. The Contras are not seen as a viable military force by anyone. By anyone. It's not their goal. Maybe someday the hope is we'll get them there, but the goal is simply economically destabilize and terrorize the people. Okay. Psychological warfare. What are some examples of that? If you're in Nicaragua, you can flip on the radio and you'll get access to US-backed Contra radio stations. And these are the kind of messages they beam into Nicaragua. The Sandinistas, which is the largest and ruling party in Nicaragua, the Sandinistas are evil. The Sandinistas are communists. The Sandinistas are burning churches. The Sandinistas are killing old people and making them into soap. The Sandinistas are taking all of our food supplies and they're shipping it to Cuba and the Soviet Union, and that's why we're hungry, etc., etc., etc. Incredible levels of propaganda. In Costa Rica, the Costa Rican newspapers, one of them or more, have supplements written by a guy who's now one of the directors of the largest Contra force about what's happening in Nicaragua. And it was a tremendous effort to convince the Central American peoples, particularly the people of Honduras and El Salvador and others, that Nicaragua's a menace. You don't want anything to do with Nicaragua. Why? Can you imagine what campesinos in Honduras would do, who have been struggling for land for years, if they knew that in Nicaragua land was being given to campesinos? It's a very, very dangerous thing. So that's part of the psychological warfare. Another, the management of internal news within the Central American countries. Good example of that is, again, Edgar Chamorro, former Contra leader. He testified before the World Court and said that the US CIA had bought and paid for 14 of the key journalists, both in terms of writing media, radio media, TV media, and paid for them and had them printing stories for them all throughout Honduras about the threat of Nicaragua, etc. So management of the news. Okay. Other US-directed disinformation campaigns. One of the things I had an opportunity to do was to meet with two pretty high-level CIA officials who have left the agency. And both of them indicated to me that the fundamental purpose of the Central Intelligence Agency is not information gathering. That's what most of us think. It's disinformation in service to illegal presidential objectives. One of those CIA agents said that there are many, perhaps hundreds, of US journalists writing for major US newspapers and on the major media who work for the Central Intelligence Agency. Probably unknown to their bosses. Okay, so disinformation campaign. You heard about the white papers related to El Salvador. You see that most of the news that we get on Central America is State Department releases other things. Okay, another psychological is the use of the National Guard. We had reporters go down from Minnesota to accompany the National Guard, and they came back and they said, I don't know what all the fuss is about National Guard going to Honduras. They're just delivering mail. It's not what they do. They do a lot of other things. But there's a propaganda thing about National Guard building a road for the people, and we're there. And meanwhile, the military exercises are going on, the training exercises are going on, the roads connecting the different military bases are going on, etc. Sheep's in, or wolves in sheep's clothing. And then terrorism is a part of the psychological warfare. People live in terror in the war zones of Nicaragua, with very good reason. And it creates a certain kind of climate. Okay, diplomatic warfare. Work to discredit the Nicaraguan elections. Almost no one in the U.S. knows that Nicaragua had elections that were found by the international community to be basically fair and free. The invention of the MIG crisis, right? That's what we remember about Nicaragua's elections. Nicaragua, if it gets MIGs, we're going to blow them up. Everybody knows that. No one remembers the elections. Brilliant. I mean, this is brilliant stuff. You've got to give them credit if it weren't so frightening. Okay, other is you narrow Nicaragua's options. Nicaragua tried to get military assistance from the United States to build its army after Somoza was ousted. U.S. said no. France said yes. U.S. strangles France. Nicaragua has nowhere to go. Where do they go? Eastern Bloc, Soviet Union. All that's diplomatic effort. You undermine the Contador peace process. People probably heard that term. U.S. has blocked all efforts for negotiated settlements coming out of Latin America and try to impose a militaristic solution on the Central American people. International slander campaigns about the terrible human rights situation in Nicaragua and the persecution of the church and the communists all over the place. All of those things are part of international diplomatic efforts. And then lastly, and I will welcome a question on this in terms of the diplomatic, the most brilliant change that we've seen in U.S. policy in the last 7 years of elections in Central America as a substitute for democracy. In other words, you carry out elections and a candidate like Duarte in El Salvador wins, Christian Democrat. But Duarte doesn't have a shred of power. He doesn't have an ounce of power, but he is a tremendous international smokescreen. So that the U.S. now can give between $1.5 million and $2 million a day in aid to El Salvador. Why? Because Jose Napoleon Duarte won the presidential election. The embassy runs the country, the military runs the country, Duarte is a convenient puppet, but it works beautifully. And you're going to see more of that.
And all the time we're sowing the horn.
And all the time we're sowing, that's right, it becomes the justification for a further militarization. Okay, and then military, the Contras build up the Salvadorans, build up the Hondurans, U.S. military advisors doing the training, joint military exercises, planes coming over from Panama, giving the Contras pinpoint descriptions of the movements of people in northern Nicaragua in the war zones, all kinds of military, the National Guard and reserves. Third country suppliers, the use of Israel, the use of Saudi Arabia, we'll talk more about that tomorrow too, the use of diversion of funds from Iran, all kinds of ways of fueling a war effort in Nicaragua. And of course, the National Security Council and their private efforts, and that's the topic of tomorrow, the secret team that's been operating. Okay, give me one more minute. Is it working? My answer is no, it's not working very well at all. The region is in economic crisis. Economic situation gets worse every day. That fuels more social turmoil within the countries that the U.S. is trying to put a lid on social turmoil. Salvador has an earthquake in October that just rips open the society and the wounds, and people start organizing and the mass movement starts building. How can you predict an earthquake or control it? Honduras and El Salvador, who are the U.S. principal allies in the region, can't stand each other and have tremendous historical tensions. And the U.S. is trying to smooth those over. But most people, or many people at least in Honduras, know they don't have any problem with Nicaragua. They've never had any problem with Nicaragua. Their real enemy is El Salvador, and they see the El Salvadoran military So that doesn't work very well. The Contras aren't a viable military force, and all they do is destroy things, so they don't create any popular support in Nicaragua. They just alienate the people even further. Diplomatic defeats. The World Court condemns the United States. Our Western European allies condemn the United States. They say that the NATO alliance is about to fall apart because of the illegality and immorality of our policy in Central America. Contragate happens. Hassenfuss gets shot down. All this stuff starts coming out so that it doesn't work very well. Cruz, the Duarte of the Contra, Arturo Cruz, resigns because he's fed up and can't stand what the Contra does. So the whole thing starts to unravel. So what does that mean? We'll get into it tomorrow more. But what it means is we have an opportunity to either fundamentally reassess who we are as a people and what the policy should be in Central America, or we are headed for a direct U.S. military invasion of Central America, an invasion that has been very well prepared. It's not preferred for all the reasons I've talked about. An invasion is a result of a failed policy, but it's very much one of the possibilities. Okay, I'll stop there. And we've only got 22 or 23 minutes for questions and conversation. Yeah?
I've learned one thing that strikes me is that sometimes things are neither black nor white. And I was wondering, concerning Nicaragua, there must have been things that I studied about like Neil Lehrer when we were going to some especially from the Catholic Church, debating on whether the church repression in Nicaragua, and there were sharp differences.
Right.
What are some things that the Nicaraguan government is doing that they are doing which you don't feel comfortable with, which is causing some of this, or actions they could take which might ease this, other than the actions that our country needs to take?
I'm going to defer some of that to the Saturday session, and realizing that not all of you are going to be there on Saturday. But the reason I do that is that there are really a couple of issues operating here. One is, what's happening inside of Nicaragua? And that's a fascinating issue. And that Saturday I want to focus on that. The good and the bad and the in-between, etc. But what I want to focus in on is there is nothing going on in Nicaragua that justifies this. And the real issues posed by Nicaragua, for me, most of those issues are what are the implications for us. So I'm going to do that on Saturday. I'll talk about the good things, the bad things, etc. But I think it's real important for us to focus on the implication of this strategy. Even if Nicaragua were guilty of all the things that we say about it, this is despicable. This is dangerous for us. Now, what have the Nicaraguans tried to do in terms of some of this stuff? The Nicaraguans have done a lot of things, including taking the United States to the World Court. That's a non-military solution in saying, okay, well, if we're guilty of all the things you say we are, then let's take it to that court and let's hear about that. But let us bring our case, and they did that. They won. What did the U.S. do? They approved $100 million in Contra aid, said we don't care about the World Court. The last country that said that, by the way, that pulled out of a decision like that was Iran during the hostage crisis. You know what we said about Iran? Iran does not belong in the community of nations. And then we repeat what Iran did. What else has Nicaragua done? Nicaragua has been very much pushing for this Contadora peace process, which is this Latin American initiative to try to demilitarize the region. What would that do? It would prevent any foreign military bases from being in Central America, U.S., Soviet, anybody's. It would remove all foreign military advisors. That means the U.S. military advisors would go home from Central America. Nicaragua would have to send home, I think they have about 600 Cuban military advisors. They would go home. It would prevent the importation of offensive weapons into Central America. By the way, almost all the independent studies of Nicaragua's military concludes that it's a defensive military. It has very little offensive military capacity. What I'm trying to say is I think there are many, many diplomatic kinds of things that are going on that Nicaragua's been trying that the U.S. has blocked every time. And the reason for that is the U.S. can't stomach a peaceful solution, because it would have to accept the existence of the Sandinistas, which it won't do. So I'll talk more specifically about the internal dynamics on Saturday.
A few weeks ago, there was a news item that one of the U.S. Governors tried to stop sending his National Guard to Honduras for training exercise. How did that come out? I think we're Supreme Court.
I have not heard the decision. The governor who's leading that is Governor Rudy Perpich from my state of Minnesota. And he got, Sarah, do you know how many governors he got to sign on to that?
Well, it's a different one. Now, I did read that article in the Christian Science Monitor when you were gone, but I forget which governor it is, but they're working with Perpich on it.
Oh, they are, okay. But it hadn't been decided yet, had it?
No, but they're like about a dozen, maybe, or maybe less than that, probably.
The problem, I mean, that's a really positive thing, and the reason, in fact, when it first came up, I don't know how many of you know, a bill was passed that took that authority away from the governors. The governors used to have authority over that. They took it away.
For any governor.
For every governor. And now they're trying to, a few of the governors are trying to challenge that and say that you're taking away that power, which was ours, is unconstitutional. So that's where it is. The problem is, I suspect, is that if you know anything about the National Guard budget, almost all of it comes from federal funds. And I can almost guarantee you that the discussion with the governors is going something like this. Ease off, or we'll cut that budget. Well, all you got to do, you can just travel around Minnesota and you'll see that there is a whole lot of activity and work and people who are tied up in those millions and millions of dollars coming in for that. So it creates a real tense situation for, I think our governor would not like the National Guard to go there, and he's going to try to do something about it, but they've got to be under intense pressure in terms of the loss of federal dollars. Yeah, sure.
I have two quick ones, if you'll permit me. The first is a question about, don't we have a film by the Christic Institute that's similar, that covers some of this stuff, and if possible, could it be shown sometime while you're doing, at least 3 days while you're doing your sessions, to give us a little more information, maybe? Just to think about. Secondly, in regards to that, it almost seems to me like this strategy is so well developed and is being implemented in so many different ways that it almost seems like we as American people are almost impotent in affecting this. Because, I mean, even a letter to our senators or our congresspeople, the decision has to go from the House to the Department of Defense. It has to get infiltrated and go through all the bureaucracy that has to you know, to get the wheels turning in order to do something. I mean, how will this whole strategy, how could this be addressed by?
Okay, answer the first one first and the second one second. First one is, yes, I do have a tape from the Christic Institute. The problem with the tape, I mean, anybody is welcome, if people are interested, we can try to do this. Problem is the tape is 2 hours long. And what it deals with is it deals with not so much in detail of this, although it's all related, but it deals with the subject that I'm going to try to put into like a half-hour presentation tomorrow. And then maybe if people want to sign up or something, we can schedule a time. If you want to really see it from the horse's mouth and you don't mind spending an hour and a half or 2 hours doing that, that's fine. The tape is here. But I'm going to try to cover the information that's in that tape, summarize it in an understandable form in a half hour tomorrow so that we can talk about it. So, but if people want to see, we can do that. Second one, what makes this very difficult in terms of trying to respond is that, one, I believe that most of this low intensity conflict stuff is very much a bipartisan effort. In other words, it's a little different with the Contras. There's some debate, although the Democrats, one of my favorite cartoons was a picture of them checking in their spines before the last Contra vote. I don't know if any of you saw that. All these humped over people going by like a hat rack with their spines. So, but there's some, at least, debate there. On El Salvador, there's no debate. El Salvador, the Democrats and the Republicans all love Jose Napoleon Duarte. So that leads me to wonder, either they don't know what's going on, or they do and they've really bought into it. And so that, one of the things I would urge you to do is write to your congresspeople, each of you, and say, I've been hearing a little bit about low-intensity conflict, and I'm very interested in finding out from you more about what this is. What that would do is, if they know, well, then you maybe can find that out. If they don't know, they're going to have to find out, and you'll find out what they know, and maybe they'll send you something. Now, having said that, I think it's really, there's no more important issue right now than that I see, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow, than getting the real Contragate story out and dealt with. Because what the hearings have turned into is a platform for raising support for the Contras. That's also a bipartisan effort for the most part, for reasons I'll explain tomorrow. But to put pressure on there is one leverage point on this. And the second one is that Contra aid vote that's coming up again in the fall that's being built towards. If that gets approved, I'm going to say that it's a disaster for the people of Central America. It's also a major step towards authoritarianism in our own country. That's my view. Yes?
We've got quite a list of things up there that are taking place, but if the United States were to withdraw support of the Contras and perhaps maintain some of their economic policies, but every country has those against other countries, what would be the most likely two or three things that would happen in Nicaragua? What would be the pluses and what would be the minuses? And what would be the direction things would go based upon the political situation?
I would say if the United States were to stop funding the Contras, that one, that would open up the real possibility for a negotiated solution. Because the only thing standing in the way of the Contador peace process, which has a number of components, one of them, the main one, is dealing with the military situation, trying to demilitarize, and I kind of summarize what that would do. That would be possible. Second, it opens up the possibility for more economic trade and cooperation that existed between these countries years ago that had been destroyed. So it opens up that possibility between the countries. Within the countries, and within Nicaragua in particular, what it would mean is that the Nicaraguan government would now be free to utilize its resources for what it said were its revolutionary goals. And the three top priorities, and I'll talk more about this on Saturday, are education, health care, and land reform, agricultural production. And the purpose of this war is precisely to bring about that shift. In 1980, Nicaragua was spending 7% of its budget on the military. Today, it's spending between 50 and 60% of its budget on the military to survive this onslaught. So the result would be the freeing up of economic resources for development rather than for warfare.
Okay, now the question I have, I understand that this opens up possibilities. The question is would those things happen in that environment?
If the United States...
We hear a lot of arguments in different situations about what they're going to do when life is easier and all the outside influences are gone.
Right.
And they never happen.
I don't know that I can give you a guarantee, but what I can do is cite the history. In 1980 and 1981, 1982, Nicaragua had the fastest growing economy in Central America. 1980, 1981, 1982, Nicaragua had the highest investment rate of any country in Latin America. 1980, 1981, 1982, hundreds of schools were built. Teachers were trained. Literacy crusade was carried out. Healthcare posts were put up all over the country. I think there's a fairly good... we'll also talk about some mistakes in terms of Atlantic Coast and different things. We'll get to those on Saturday. But if we look at history, I think there's a pretty good indication that the present Nicaraguan government, which was a popularly elected government in fair elections, was very committed to making internal economic changes that would improve the lives of its people. Now, there are many other obstacles to that, by the way. I mean, the war damage isn't going to go away. The international trading system, which discriminates against the exports of underdeveloped countries, that's not going to change with the war ending. The debt situation isn't going to... So there's a lot of other things that would really have to change. But if you're asking me, do I think that the present Nicaraguan government, if it were at peace, what would they do? My answer is that they would continue with those reforms that were moving really quite well and that made Nicaragua one of the most exciting countries in the world. And now Nicaragua is one of the most depressing ones in terms of what's happening to the people. Okay, here and then I'll go up.
I want to ask on question 5, is it working? You know, your answer related to what was going on in those countries in spite of all the efforts we're making. In my low-level involvement in the last 5 years. I've not been impressed that we've made a whole lot of progress in this country in informing the populace. And, you know, the little group in Salem, Oregon that tries to support the Central American information programs and things like that hasn't grown a bit. It seems like the same few people march.
Uh-huh.
You have a sense for that on a larger scale as you travel around?
Repeat the question, and I'll summarize it as, what is happening internally in the United States in terms of, is there building opposition to the policy, or is it the same as it was a long time ago? Is there any progress being made on that? I would answer in two ways. One, that compared to the Vietnam War, we are miles and miles ahead, which is to say that you have many more groups who are organized, many more groups who understand what's going on, many more groups who are committed to education and action, many more protests, many more people who have signed their name and said, if we invade Nicaragua, I'll do X. So that's all positive. Second thing I would say is that there has been a certain amount of skepticism in the U.S. people towards this policy, despite an incredible propaganda effort on the other side. You know, most of the polls were saying 69% of the people were opposed to the Contra funding. Now, what makes that frightening, that's good, but what frightens me is that the same polls show that more than half of those people don't know who the Contras are or what side the United States is funding. And that's what the Reagan administration uses. And that's why they go ahead with their policy. They're not all that concerned. And that's why someone like these hearings are so dangerous. Because people don't know. And what they're being given through these hearings is the opportunity to hear about all these great freedom-loving Americans, which will puncture a huge hole in tomorrow. Democratic-loving Americans who are, well, maybe they were a little misguided in what they did, etc. So that's real scary. In other words, it's a real fickle thing. The last thing I'll say is, I think if it were not for as many U.S. people who have traveled to Central America, as much work has gone on, there would have been an invasion of Nicaragua already. It would have been wiped off the face of the map very early on. And so I think that's not my definition of great success, because obviously things aren't going very well, but it is somewhat hopeful and makes the work that we do important, because we can't always judge the work we do by the goal that we want to see, but maybe by something that we've prevented. So it's a real fickle population. There are some reasons for optimism and some reasons to be really scared right now. Yeah, Barry.
I was just going to add one thing to the question you'd asked about what would happen if we stopped funding the Contras. I think another thing that would happen is that we would find that Nicaragua would be less economically and militarily dependent on the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. That dependence and relationship has grown as the United States has stepped up our own support of the Contras, and that if they were free to other international markets, we would find that the relationship there they would be much less aligned in some ways than we want to put them there now.
Yeah, interesting, I'll talk about this on Saturday. One role that the Soviet Union is playing in Nicaragua today is it's pushing the Nicaraguans and pushing the Latin American countries to take on more of the cost of helping Nicaragua survive. And in fact, it's the opposite of what my fear is. I mean, and maybe what the strategy is. In other words, I think the Soviets understand quite well. First of all, I'll say the Nicaraguans don't want to be dependent on anybody. And they've made it very clear that a foundation of their revolution is they want to diversify their economic and trade and diplomatic relationships. And they've been quite successful at that. But Barry's point is a good one, but it's interesting. The role that the Soviet Union has been playing in the last 6 months has been, rather than capitalize on this very difficult situation that Nicaragua is in and say, okay, now you do X for us if we're going to do X for you, has been, in fact, they're lobbying the Latin American countries and saying, we don't want to create a situation in which the U.S. can justify an invasion of Nicaragua based on their dependency on us. Now, I find that pretty fascinating. We can talk more about that on Saturday. Yeah.
I think history has shown that the Marines have always followed Standard Oil. Is that pretty much the same philosophy here that the Reagan administration is protecting the Rockefellers, whoever is down there, gutting the country out of their resources?
There's two fundamental causal factors, it seems to me. One is ideological and one is economic, and it's hard to separate them at times. But I'll talk tomorrow when we examine the secret team that's been running U.S. foreign policy. When you examine them ideologically, they in fact are true believers that there is a communist in each of us, and that there is a communist behind every bush, and that everything that's going on there is communistic, and communists not only deserve to die, but we're going to kill them. I mean that quite literally. Hundreds of thousands of people have been assassinated by this same team that's operating now the policy. So part of it is ideological. The second aspect is economic. And if you read the Kissinger Commission report, do people remember that report? President Reagan appointed this commission, and supposed to be bipartisan, they were coming up with suggestions. One of the things they say in that report, and I examine that report fairly carefully, is they say a threat to any U.S. interest anywhere in the world, no matter how small, is a threat to the entire global system and has to be treated as such. In other words, if you look at Nicaragua and you say, does Nicaragua's resources and potential resource development warrant what we're doing to it in terms of the millions and millions and millions of dollars that we're spending trying to destroy it and take it back over? The answer is probably no. But if you see that Nicaragua is a threat because it can be an example to other countries in the world about some of the internal economic changes, and it might give poor people in other countries an idea that's going to really call for a restructuring, then absolutely, there is a tremendous fear that poor people are going to start demanding a share of the world's resources. And that's one of the things that makes Nicaragua so dangerous. So it's a yes and no. It's not always just a direct economic link. Okay, they got oil there. But it can be more indirect than that. I'm going to see if anybody who hasn't asked one first, and then I'll come back to you if we get time, okay? Yeah?
How much of this set of realities is dependent on the Reagan administration being in power? What will happen?
Right, it's a very good question. Well, how much of this is dependent upon the Reagan administration and how much is deeper than that? Well, I'll say this. First of all, the Reagan administration is very important to this and is very supportive and has surrounded itself with people and by people who share a worldview that's very committed to this. And so there is a difference between what's happening under President Reagan and what was happening under Jimmy Carter, for example. Now, having said that, what I'll talk about tomorrow is that, in fact, this secret team, which is what the Christic Institute calls it, that's made up of people like Oliver North, Secord, Singlob, Owen, and some others, that they have been operating in the bowels of the U.S. government since 1960, and that they've been coordinating the same programs in Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam, overthrow of Allende in Chile, and all kinds of things. So that part of my answer to your question is, our problem is a lot deeper than that. It's a lot deeper than that. And it, for me, that's where it makes it really important that I see myself, first of all, as a Christian living in this country and responsible to try to change the policies. Because the criticism goes much beyond Republican-Democrat here. It's a much deeper, from my point of view, it's a much deeper sickness in the U.S. society that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think... That's right, he does. Okay, I think we're going to have to end this, and again, I invite anybody to the session tomorrow to pick up on this question in particular. Thanks.